Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, December 7th, 2025. This program was previously broadcast on December 22nd, 2024. If you're still looking for that perfect gift, why not consider a book, a science book in particular? From Science News, these are Science News' favorite books of 2024. By the Science News staff, posted on December 10, 2024. Books contemplating the human experience and some of humankind's greatest challenges were among the Science News staff's favorite reads this year. What were your favorites? You can let us know at feedback@sciencenews.org. Night Magic by Leigh-Anne Hennion, published by Algonquin Books, $30. As artificial light increasingly illuminates nighttime, a writer makes the case to preserve natural darkness and the ecosystems and life forms it nurtures, from spotted salamanders to glowworms and bioluminescent fungi. Again, that's Night Magic, written by Leigh-Anne Hennion. Do I Know You? By Sadie Dingfelder, published by Little Brown Spark, $32. A science journalist who can't recognize faces, perceive depth, or visualize images in her mind takes readers along on her journey to understand her quirky brain. The hilarious and philosophical memoir is a reminder that our ways of perceiving the world are not uniform. That book is Do I Know You? By Sadie Dingfelder. Next, Then I Am Myself the World by Christoph Koch. Published by Basic Books, $30. A neuroscientist argues that information integration in the brain is what makes humans conscious. The idea provocatively suggests that any system that integrates information, including computers, has the potential for some level of consciousness. And that is Then I Am Myself the World by Christoph Koch. Flavorama by Arielle Johnson, published by Harvest, $40. Complete with colorful illustrations and fun recipes, this delicious tome digs into the science behind flavor. Reading it just might transform your skills in the kitchen. And that is Flavorama by Eric H. Klein. After 11-11-75 BC by Arielle Johnson. After 11-77 BC by Eric H. Klein, published by Princeton University, $32. An archaeologist describes how the Late Bronze Age collapse transformed societies across the Eastern Mediterranean and Near East, with some experiencing hardship and decline, while others flourished amid the chaos. After 1177 BC, by Eric H. Klein. Get the Picture by Bianca Bosker, published by Viking, $29. Wielding science as a tool, a journalist sets out to understand humankind's primal desire for art, as well as art's expanding utility in the modern world. Along the way, she immerses herself in the exclusive and bizarre art world. The Last Drop by Tim Smedley, published by Picador, $29.99. Human mismanagement and climate change are fueling water crises around the globe. This book offers potential solutions, from agricultural and at-home remedies to policy changes, as well as a reminder to value every last drop of water as precious. The High Seas by Olive Heffernan, published by Greystone Books, cost $32.95. People are increasingly staking claims to international waters to exploit resources. A science journalist sounds the alarm for sustainable practices and the preservation of the ocean's rich ecosystems. That book is The High Seas by Olive Heffernan. Turning to Stone by Marcia Bjornerud, published by Flatiron Books, $29.99. A seasoned structural geologist reflects on her life story and the rich wisdom of Earth's rocks in this book that is part memoir and geology explainer, part meditation on science. Again, Turning to Stone by Marcia Bjornerud, published by Flatiron Books. How to Kill an Asteroid by Robin George Andrews, published by Random House, 2999. What will it take to protect Earth from a destructive asteroid? A science journalist takes stock of the tools humankind already has in its asteroid preparedness arsenal, including the defensive strategy demonstrated by NASA's successful DART mission, and what else is still needed. Our Moon by Rebecca Boyle, published by Random House, 2899. This veneration of our celestial companion lays out how the Moon has shaped life on Earth and molded the planet into a hospitable home. The Moon's influence on human societies, both culturally and spiritually, as well as the threats humankind's material ambitions pose for the Moon's well-being, also take center stage. That is Our Moon by Rebecca Boyle. And finally, Countdown by Sarah Scholes, published by Bold Type Books, for $30. Interviews with physicists tasked to maintain and modernize the United States' aging nuclear stockpile, as well as with other researchers and activists in that orbit, reveal the intense and often heavy feelings of those in the nuclear weapon industry. These conversations ponder the industry's contradictory existence to promote peace through destructive weapons and the future of nuclear research. And you can buy these books from bookshop.org. Science News is a bookshop.org affiliate and will earn a commission on purchases made from links in this article. And now we take a look at more reviews, some of the books recommended by Science News. First, Flavorama. Flavorama guides readers through the complex landscape of flavor. Ariel Johnson explains how to think like a scientist in the kitchen. Understanding the science of flavor makes for more delicious cooking, a new book explains. The review is by Karen Kwan and was posted on April 29, 2024. What gives a lemon its lemoniness? It's the physical molecules within the fruit. A bite into a lemon wedge sends citric acid molecules and other compounds to the tongue and through the nose, a 1-2 punch of the sour taste and citrusy scent that the brain senses as lemony. Being a combination of taste and smell makes flavor a challenge for people who want to master it. There are 5 distinct tastes: salty, sour, sweet, umami, and bitter. And the tongue has dedicated receptors for detecting molecules that correspond to each one. Smell is more complicated, with about 400 types of smell receptors in the nose that capture signals from many, many different molecules. Taken together, this means a near infinite number of flavors exists. Perhaps there's no better guide to this complex landscape than Ariel Johnson. She not only has a PhD in chemistry, but she also was the resident scientist at NOMA, a fine dining establishment in Copenhagen that has been named the world's best restaurant 5 times since it opened in 2003. Johnson distills her expertise in both the kitchen and the lab in Flavorama, a guide to unlocking the art and science of flavor. In Flavorama, a guide to unlocking the art and science of flavor. Complete with colorful illustrations and fun recipes, the book is a satisfying read regardless of your familiarity with science or cooking. Flavorama is split into sections that each feature one of Johnson's laws of flavor. After establishing that flavor is molecules, she moves on to flavor is taste and smell. Smell, perhaps counterintuitively, often influences flavor more than taste does, thanks to the numerous smell receptors, she explains. Smell can also evoke emotional memories more intensely than other sensory inputs. Hand-drawn illustrations of the human brain and nasal cavity explain why, by showing how nerve cells that line the roof of the nasal cavity detect scent molecules and send signals directly to the limbic system, a part of the brain that handles feelings and memories. Other sensory inputs, in contrast, are first processed in different parts of the brain before arriving at the limbic system. Johnson dives deep into different tastes and smells to illustrate her next law. Flavor follows predictable patterns. Johnson peppers recipes throughout this section to highlight each taste and smell category. One atypical recipe, umami-boosted cacio e pepe, urges readers to add anchovies and nutritional yeast to this traditional Italian pasta dish of cheese and black pepper to boost the umami flavor that can be hard for some to pinpoint. Identifying flavors is something most of us can learn to do, Johnson argues. The next law proclaims that flavor can be concentrated, extracted, and infused. By moving flavor molecules around selectively, you can make a flavor more intense or more diffused, and its medium more viscous or more liquid. For instance, juicing can remove flavorless solids from a tasty liquid like orange juice. The chemical principle of like dissolves like can help extract flavor molecules, such as in concocting compound butter. When mixed with garlic, butter and its fats draw out the aromatic ingredient's oily molecules, complementing the butter's flavor. Johnson would be the first to tell you that Flavorama will not help you make the perfect chocolate chip cookie or avoid mistakes in the kitchen. What the book teaches instead is how to use flavor science as a liberating tool for improvising when the unexpected inevitably happens. Did the butcher run out of the short ribs the recipe calls for? Did the grocery store have only sad-looking parsley? Thinking like a flavor scientist can help you identify an alternative ingredient that can save the day. A reminder that Flavorama, written by Ariel Johnson, is published by Harvest, and the price is $40. And again, you can buy Flavorama from bookshop.org. Next, an in-depth review of Countdown, which takes stock of the U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile. Physicists at Nuclear Weapons Labs reveal their motivations in the book. The United States is working to modernize its aging nuclear weapons, such as the Nuclear Intercontinental Ballistic Missile. The review is written by Emily Conover and posted on March 5, 2024. Physicists at Nuclear Weapons Labs reveal their motivations in the book. To work on nuclear weapons, the author Sarah Scull's conversations reveal, is to embrace seemingly contradictory ideas. The weapons promote peace by deterring countries from attacking each other. The weapons also make possible the destruction of civilization. The researchers see their work on a variety of topics, from computer simulations of nuclear weapons to non-proliferation research, as necessary, and even find beauty in it, but some also dream of a world without these bombs. The United States has not tested nuclear weapons since the 1990s, when it signed the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. To maintain confidence in its roughly 3,700 nuclear weapons, the country aims to replace the steadily degrading nuclear material at their hearts. These bowling ball-sized pits are hollow spheres of plutonium that kick off the nuclear explosion when a bomb detonates. Currently, the United States is stuck with its aging pits, but by 2030, the plan is to produce 80 pits per year. Yet some activists oppose the pit production and other modernization efforts, the details of which are classified and thus unknown to the public. While proponents see updating the weapons as essential to shore up the deterrent, others think the deterrent is effective as is and worry modernizing could kick off a dangerous arms race. The book Countdown also delves into the history and culture of the national labs focused on nuclear work. While some of it seems like inside baseball, this or that management change, there is serious tea spilled. One scientist says Los Alamos is in a 1950s bubble, lamenting the lab's seeming focus on the cult of genius, the outdated model in which a lone researcher transforms a field. And Scholes recounts drama from decades prior of employees at Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico and Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, rebelling against management. The best way they knew how: angry blog posts and at least one snarky limerick. With witty attention to detail, Scholes inserts moments of levity, pointing out the small absurdities surrounding this otherwise heavy topic. She meets a scientist at Los Alamos Hot Rocks Java Cafe, a place whose name suggests the 1990s came up with it. And the scientists' passion for their field shines through, like the feeling of exhilaration that comes with taming plasma, a feral state of matter consisting of electrically charged particles. At times, the book leaves the reader craving more scientific details, perhaps unavoidable when dealing with a classified subject. But some topics are glossed over more than necessary. The discussion of quantum computing, a technology that might eventually be useful for simulating nuclear weapons, is so abbreviated as to be confusing. Throughout the book, Scholes highlights the deep connections that run between basic scientific research and nuclear applications. The conditions in an atomic bomb are similar to those elsewhere in the universe, such as in exploding stars. That means that even physicists who set out to reveal basic features of the universe might inadvertently advance knowledge about nuclear weapons. Like it or not, physics and nuclear weapons are inseparable. The researchers Scholes profiles hope that by understanding nuclear weapons better, we might protect ourselves from them. One research team aims to improve the detection of nuclear blasts, making it easier to verify that other countries aren't setting them off. But such knowledge could also teach a government how to hide its own tests from prying eyes. Like so much else in nuclear weapons research, there are two sides. And this review of Countdown by Sarah Scholes was written by Emily Conover and published March 5th, 2024 in Science News. And finally, a third review of one of Science News' top 10 science books for 2024. What Will It Take to Defend the World from an Asteroid? A new book examines the tools in humankind's arsenal and what's still needed. In 2022, NASA's DART spacecraft successfully shoved the distant asteroid Moonlet, Dimorphos, off course. The mission tested a potential strategy to deflect any asteroid that might someday threaten Earth. This review by Shi On Kim, posted on November 28, 2024. The book reviewed is How to Kill an Asteroid by Robin George Andrews, published by W.W. Norton and Company. The dinosaurs saw a grisly death at the hands of an asteroid, but who's to say that Earth's modern-day inhabitants won't meet the same fate? Fortunately, scientists are already hard at work to prevent that future. How to Kill an Asteroid by science journalist Robin George Andrews is a deep dive into the extremely badass business of thwarting a destructive asteroid. The book's title is a slight misnomer. As Andrews explains, the best strategy to save the planet from an impending asteroid is not to blow it up in space, though that's a reasonable last-ditch option, but instead to deflect it while it's still far beyond Earth's neighborhood. The physics of diversion is tricky. Which spacefaring rocks are harmless, and which ones are a real threat? Will scientists be able to detect and intercept one in time? And if we manage to deflect it, will the rock fragment into a gazillion deadly bullets bound for Earth? Compared with the rest of science exploration, planetary defense has a short history, beginning as a scientific thought exercise in the 1980s and ramping up in earnest in the 1990s. Andrews does an admirable job of packing in details and context about the field. His thorough research brings readers all over the world and across time, from century-past accounts of asteroids striking Earth to recent dress rehearsals of our asteroid preparedness. Enter DART, D-A-R-T, short for the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, which put on trial the world's arguably best concept for a defensive weapon against incoming asteroids. In 2021, the NASA mission hurled a spacecraft toward Dimorphos, a distant asteroid moonlet that poses no threat to Earth, to see whether it could be knocked off course. On September 26, 2022, the spacecraft face-planted onto the moonlet, successfully shoving the space rock off its orbital path. Andrews frames DART's tale as a gripping disaster thriller. An asteroid is hypothetically hell-bent on destroying Earth, and it's up to scientists, superheroes, to save the world. Though full of suspense, the writing is also at times witty and lighthearted. But for all of DART's success, How to Kill an Asteroid presents a somber truth. The DART mission concept is the only tried and tested defensive strategy humankind currently has in its anti-asteroid arsenal. The world sorely needs more. And when it comes to developing a planetary security system, we humans may be our own worst enemy. Indeed, the real challenge isn't in the science, but rather the bureaucratic surveyor, a space observatory and asteroid specialist, whose fate has become uncertain after a crucial budget cut in 2022. The world has also lost a key space sentinel. Besides being an important instrument for space science, the Arecibo Observatory, which collapsed in 2020, was also one of Earth's best watchdogs for suspicious asteroids. Beyond building the instruments to detect and deter cosmic cannonballs, asteroid preparedness also involves taming the geopolitical, social, and economic fallout. Andrews writes, "If an asteroid one day hurtles toward Earth, human fears and foibles may complicate matters. Once skywatchers sound the alarm, humankind's collective anxiety could upend everyday life long before the asteroid makes landfall or is successfully diverted. Experts have floated several doomsday scenarios that the world may need to prepare for. For instance, rampant misinformation may trigger insurance scams and crash stock markets. Countries might jumpstart their nuclear development programs under the guise of flinging weapons at the asteroid. Other nations might take advantage of the chaos to invade their neighbors. The world might see mass migration out of the predicted ground zone." Nevertheless, How to Kill an Asteroid is overall more hopeful than fear-stoking. It reminds us that the world has no shortage of ideas for how to thwart an asteroid strike. And it is a rallying cry for a reinvestment in planetary defense programs to ensure we're ready for the real thing. Scientists are already more than eager to help. And How to Kill an Asteroid was written by Robin George Andrews. And these are in-depth reviews of the top science books from Science News for 2024. In summary, the top 12 books that Science News chose as its favorite books of 2024 are Night Magic, Do I Know You, Then I Am Myself the World, Flavorama, After 1177, Get the Picture, The Last Drop, The High Seas, Turning to Stone, How to Kill an Asteroid, Our Moon, and Count. Smithsonian Magazine also offers its top science books for 2024. From a deep dive on a fatal space shuttle disaster to a study of a dozen iconic trees, these are our favorite titles this year. And there are 10 of them. The summary of these 10 is written by Joe Spring, Riley Black, Sheehan Kim, Dan Falk, Christian Elliott, and Benjamin Cassidy. This year, millions of viewers looked to the sky during a momentous day in April to view a stunning total solar eclipse. During silent nights throughout the year, they gazed at spectacular auroras. As record heat spread over our planet again this year, Atlantic hurricanes fueled by warm waters hit the United States hard. And in Iceland, eruptions that spewed vibrant lava captivated audiences around the world. Aside from writing and editing stories about these events and others, our editors read a lot this year, and so did our contributors. We asked our writers what books moved them the most, and they had plenty of suggestions. After a lot of back and forth, and a really hard time narrowing down the selections, we picked 10 favorites. You can read reviews of these titles below, which include works about whether the Earth is alive, our relationship to the moon, and how and why we remember. First, The Light Eaters, written by Zoe Schlanger. Plants surround us, yet their lives are so different from ours that even a dandelion can seem alien. Zoe Schlanger's The Light Eaters looks beyond the leaves and branches to how our verdant neighbors perceive our world, offering a plant's eye view of life. No one yet really knows the limits of what a plant can do, Schlanger writes early in the book, or even what plants truly are. Green life has often felt closer to the abiotic worlds of weather and geology, what we often lump under the broad label of nature. But Schlanger's conversations and explorations with botanists seek to understand plants on their own terms. Plant seeds, for example, don't only need soil, sun, and water, but also have cells that are assessing the outside world and decide when the time is right for the new plant to begin emerging. Such a decision-making center, Schlanger writes, was unknown until 2017. From such examples, The Light Eaters unfolds as an anthropology of plant life, exploring debate and discovery about what plants have and what they might discern. Ultimately, Schlanger acknowledges that the concept remains untested. The Light Eaters, nevertheless, shines on the question of whether plants can be said to communicate, have social lives, and even move with intent. Schlanger's personal and curious quest to ask these questions is the core of the book, an effort to see what might be discovered if we look at plants as more than just houseplants and forests. Perhaps this amorphous quality of plant intelligence I'm trying to grasp, she writes, is as much to do with plant trying, plant testing, plant failing. This review by Riley Black. Next, Challenger, A True Story of Heroism and Disaster on the Edge of Space, by Adam Higginbotham. For millions of students across the United States, January 28, 1986 became an unsettling day they would remember vividly for the rest of their lives. Many sat in classrooms and auditoriums watching television to see the launch of Christa McAuliffe, the first teacher set to go to space, aboard the space shuttle Challenger. But just 73 seconds after liftoff, the craft lit up, broke apart, and crashed down into the Atlantic Ocean, killing the 7 people on board. The explosion replayed again and again on news coverage, leaving people of all ages wondering what happened and why. In Challenger, Adam Higginbotham answers those questions thoroughly in an engaging narrative. The book delves into the history of spaceflight, including the prior Apollo 1 tragedy that led up to Challenger's fatal mission. Higginbotham brings readers into the lives of astronauts, engineers, and bureaucrats involved with NASA's space program. He shares the stories of the crew members who died and the engineers who were involved in the launching of Challenger on that cold January morning. He includes details about how the families reacted after the explosion. The information leakers who made sure the truth was revealed, and how the disaster came together. That report revealed the account that Higginbotham writes about, writing of cost-cutting, faulty design, management blunders, and institutional hubris. And yet, NASA did not entirely learn from that lesson, as Higginbotham details with the story of another fatal mishap, the 2003 disintegration of the shuttle Columbia, showing how history was once again doomed to repeat itself. This review by Joe Spring. Next, Why We Remember, Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters, People who meet neuroscientists and psychologists, Charan Ranganath, tend to ask him the same question. Why am I so forgetful? In Why We Remember, he turns that question on its head, drawing on 25 years of experience studying the mechanisms of human memory to explain how remarkable it is that we remember anything at all. We are designed, he writes, to forget. Malleability and flexibility were more useful than photographic accuracy to our ancestors navigating a constantly changing, dangerous world. Our brains are not memorization machines. They are thinking machines, optimized by evolution to help us survive. Using everyday examples, losing your keys, failing to remember why you entered a room, forgetting the name of someone you just met at a conference, and anecdotes from years of lab experiments. He explains exactly what's happening inside your brain when you form memories and try to recall them. We meet a cast of recurring characters, the hippocampus, the prefrontal cortex, the amygdala, and learn how they worked together to wire the connections across our brains to make memory possible. Memory is less like a photograph. He touches on hot-button issues, the root cause of brain fog in long COVID, for example. But the book's key message is that, although we inevitably forget much throughout our lives, what we do remember defines who we are. Memory is much, much more than an archive of the past, he writes. It is the prism through which we see ourselves, others, and the world. It's the connective tissue underlying what we say, think, and do. This review by Kristen Elliott. Dr. Charan Ranganath is a professor of psychology and neuroscience and director of the Dynamic Memory Lab at the University of California at Davis. Like Science News, Smithsonian Magazine also chose How to Kill an Asteroid, The Real Science of Planetary Defense, as one of its top science books of 2024. Its summary: welcome to the badass business of planetary defense, where scientists safeguard Earth from the threats of asteroid strikes. In How to Kill an Asteroid, Robin George Andrews chronicles the roughly three-decade-long existence of the field that gained fame with the DART mission, which is the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, in 2022. During that mission, a sacrificial spacecraft bumped into the asteroid Dimorphos from its original orbit as a demonstration of one of humankind's plans to deal with impending cosmic missiles. In the book, Andrews entwines two main suspenseful narratives. First, he leans on the scientific research to describe the doomsday scenario that would result from an asteroid strike. Secondly, he details the nail-biting journey of DART sailing across space to meet its target, including some of the hiccups it faced that forced scientists to troubleshoot and problem-solve by the seat of their pants. Next, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine, by Daniel Levitin. Daniel Levitin, a neuroscientist and musician whose 2006 book, This Is Your Brain on Music, spent more than a year on the New York Times bestseller list, has now turned his attention to the myriad ways in which music can help to heal our bodies and our minds. His new book, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, looks at the ways music can help us cope with trauma and depression, relieve pain, strengthen our immune systems, and aid in the treatment of movement disorders such as Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, and ALS, even in the case of Alzheimer's disease, for which no cure currently exists. Levitin shows how music can loosen the disease's grip by relieving anxiety and agitation. He has had personal relationships with many of the musicians whose stories he recounts. We hear, for example, how he helped his longtime friend Joni Mitchell, who was hospitalized after suffering a brain aneurysm in 2015. On his instructions, Mitchell's nurses played a CD of tracks that she herself had previously cited as her favorites. It worked wonders, and her condition gradually improved. We also hear stories from Glenn Campbell, Bruce Springsteen, Quincy Jones, and others. These musicians' anecdotes give the book a warmth it might otherwise lack. Plenty of the book will appeal to both music fans and science buffs, but Levitin also recognizes that some degree of mystery will always surround music's ability to move us. He argues, but he understands its inherent ambiguity. As Levitin puts it, music offers a dynamic structure and meaning that our brains interpret. Ultimately, he writes, music can do so many, many things. This review written by Dan Falk. Next, What If We Get It Right? Visions of Climate Futures by Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. In What If We Get It Right? Marine biologist and policy expert Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson presents interview transcripts, poems, fact sheets, and personal essays to discuss the many ways society has to reinvent itself to tackle the climate crisis. Johnson lets readers hear directly from activists, farmers, urban planners, artists, journalists, and lawyers on myriad solutions. Climate change touches all aspects of society, says Kendra Pierre Lewis, a climate journalist Johnson interviews in the book. Thus, fixing climate change, Johnson shows, calls for an all-hands-on-deck approach, because there's no silver bullet to this massive, multifaceted problem. Refreshingly, the book offers an optimistic outlook on our climate future. Society already has the tools to fix the climate, Johnson says, so she calls on readers to put pressure on the government to formalize and hasten the use of those tools in policy. Solving climate change might seem like an insurmountable challenge, but the book reminds readers that each of us can bring meaningful change by finding where our individual talents and passions intersect, and contributing in our own unique ways. This review, filed by She and Kim. Next, 12 Trees, The Deep Roots of Our Future, by Daniel Lewis. Trees are the heartbeat of the world, he writes, in his love letter to the ancient life-giving beings. In 12 chapters, each paired with a beautiful illustration, Lewis takes readers on an arboreal journey around the world and through time. The characters, Ebony, Sandalwood, Ceiba, Redwood, and so on, quickly come to feel like old friends, their long life histories carefully told, and the stakes of their uncertain futures in the Anthropocene clearly laid out. Each tree raises big questions. How should conservationists balance the bulbous baobab's survival against that of the thirsty, endangered elephants that destroy it for water? Is an invasive tree inherently bad in a world so thoroughly transformed and reshuffled by humans? For instance, the non-native blue gum eucalyptus, omnipresent across California, is highly flammable, but it also provides critical habitat for the endangered monarch butterfly. Throughout the book, Lewis weaves in memoir, connecting his own roots with those of the trees he profiles. The toromiro, extinct on its home island of Rapa Nui, but preserved in a diaspora of botanical collections around the world, reminds the author of his own migration from Hawaii to the mainland United States, like a buoyant, salt-resistant seed on the waves. His experience as curator and historian at the famed Huntington Library comes in handy on a visit to an archive of another sort, the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research in Arizona, where he comes face to face with Prometheus, a 5,062-year-old Great Basin bristlecone pine that gave its life to transform dendrochronologists' understanding of the ancient past. It's hard to read 12 Trees, to flip through its wood pulp pages, and not see the world differently after. Lewis puts it best, trees are Earth's reporters, chronicling life and change over the long, elastic curve of history. All we need to do is listen up. This review filed by Christian Elliott. Next, Our Moon, How Earth's Celestial Companion Transformed Us and Made Us Who We Are, by Rebecca Boyle. In her debut book, Rebecca Boyle sheds new light on our familiar nighttime companion. Despite having a vast ground to cover, given the moon's 4.5 billion year entwined history with Earth, Boyle writes with clarity and wonder. The book is part encyclopedia, part lunar biography, and even part travelogue. In vivid detail, Boyle describes the sights and sensations that a person setting foot on the moon's dusty exterior would experience, thereby bringing the moon closer to readers than ever before. The book covers familiar ground, such as the Apollo missions that brought astronauts to the lunar surface, yet readers will still find factoids that surprise. Scientists hypothesize that the moon coaxed prehistoric marine life to colonize land, for example. Culturally, humankind has the moon to thank for inspiring the birth of religions, helping civilizations keep time, and tipping the outcomes of brutal wars. As humans draw up plans to return to the moon for scientific, geopolitical, and economic reasons, Boyle notes, this book reminds us that our celestial neighbor is part of our world, our culture, and our identity, and always has been. This review posted by She on Kim. Next, the language puzzle, piecing together the 6 million year story of how words evolved, by Stephen Mithen. Birds and whales sing, and vervet monkeys use alarm calls, but only humans have full-blown symbolic language. How do we get here? In The Language Puzzle, the archaeologist Stephen Mithen draws on the latest research in linguistics, anthropology, psychology, and genetics to chronicle some 1.6 million years of hominin evolution. A comparison with the Neanderthals offers some insight. Neanderthals buried their dead and likely had complex cultural rituals, but they never developed symbolic art, and they used the same kind of stone tools for millennia. Perhaps, Mithen argues, due to their lack of linguistic ability, which in turn may stem from cognitive limitations. While Neanderthals may have been able to talk about what they could see in front of them, they likely had little or no capacity for abstract thought, an ability that eventually gave our own species planet-changing powers. Mithen also discusses how language evolved from gestures, and he ponders what kinds of words were the first to appear. So-called iconic words, which include onomatopoeias such as bang and quack, and appear across cultures, may have been among the earliest. He also looks at how language abilities are distributed in the brain, and the possible role that a genetic mutation may have played in giving Homo sapiens a linguistic edge over other hominins. Parts of The Language Puzzle, especially the chapters on human biological and cultural evolution, will be familiar to those who read Yuval Noah Harari's Sapiens or Leonard Mlodinow's The Upright Thinkers. Still, Mithen's detailed and engaging book, with its laser-like focus on the role of language, offers a fresh perspective on the human story. This review by Dan Falk. And number 10 in the Smithsonian list of the best science books of 2024 is Becoming Earth, How Our Planet Came to Life, by Ferris Jauber. In the 1960s, British scientist James Lovelock asserted something that was both familiar and novel. Earth, he theorized, was a living organism. While different religions and ancient cultures had described the planet as animate for eons, Lovelock's contemporaries in the scientific community rejected this notion, preferring a Darwinian stance that identified species and environments, but not vice versa. By the time Lovelock died in 2022, at the age of 103, different iterations of what became known as the Gaia hypothesis had gained supporters, while still attracting much skepticism. Science journalist Ferris Jauber's first book, Becoming Earth, is both a testament to and modern evolution of Lovelock's theory. Jabra accompanies scientists on research expeditions, zooming in and out on the world's diverse ecosystems to demonstrate how their occupants influence the environments around them. In the depths of a former mine in South Dakota, the journalist learns how microbes carve the Earth's crust. From the perilous peak of a 1,066-foot observatory in the Amazon, he sees how the rainforest creates clouds. Shifting environments, such as those affected by climate change, of course, force species to adapt. But he details how that change doesn't always work in one direction. A kelp forest, for example, sequesters carbon and thus influences the atmosphere. Again and again, he writes, life and environment alter each other through feedback loops. Through precise reporting and lyrical reflections, Jabra's book explores a question as soulful as it is scientific. What does it mean to be alive? This review written by Benjamin Cassidy. And a note to our readers from Smithsonian. Smithsonian Magazine participates in affiliate link advertising programs. If you purchase an item through these links, we receive a commission. And a summary of the 10 best science books of 2024, chosen by Smithsonian editors. The Light Eaters, Becoming Earth, Our Moon, The Language Puzzle, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, What If We Get It Right, 12 Trees, Why We Remember, Challenger, and How to Kill an Asteroid, a book also picked by Science News as one of its top books of 2024. And how could I not end today's program with a New York Times trilobite? It also happens to be a book review. And as is true 90% of the time, the title of this trilobite is a play on words. He took a terrible, horrible, no good 800-mile hike, so you don't have to, which of course references the children's book, Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day, which is the kind of day Kevin Fodarko had. In A Walk in the Park, he recounts a trek of a lifetime that becomes a nightmare in one of America's most stunning sights. At least he can laugh about it. This review was written by Blair Braverman, who is a writer, adventurer, and dog sledder. But back to A Walk in the Park. This review was published on May 25th, 2024, originally, and updated on November 26th, 2024. The full title, which gives away the secret, A Walk in the Park, The True Story of a Spectacular Misadventure in the Grand Canyon, by Kevin Fodarko. Maybe it's when he's extracting drinking water from damp sand with a syringe, trying desperately not to die from dehydration, but there came a point in A Walk in the Park, Kevin Fodarko's memoir about walking the length of the Grand Canyon, that I thought, wow, this hike is a terrible idea. Not that this was a revelation. Fodarko says as much from the start, but I still assumed, being well-versed in the rhythms of adventure stories and the accompanying wait till you hear how bad it was, that a Grand Canyon hike wouldn't be uniquely awful. I was wrong. Fodarko grew up in Pittsburgh, in a landscape drained by coal mining and poisoned by the byproducts of industry. His family recalls the yellow mist of the Donora Death Fog, a quirk of atmospheric pressure that trapped chemical emissions over a town some 20 miles south of the city, killing at least 20 people and sickening many more. As a child, visiting his grandparents, he played on hills of strip mine waste. But when a magazine assignment brought him to the Colorado River, he fell in love with both the Grand Canyon and the elegant wooden dories that traverse it. He uprooted his life to volunteer for a tour company, handling raw sewage on rafting expeditions, in the hope of one day being promoted to the driver's seat of a dory. As he relates one grievous mishap after another, the reader faces a dawning realization. Wait, is this guy going to walk the whole canyon? because he's not good enough to row a boat? Indeed, and outdoor literature is the better for it, because a walk in the park is a triumph. Fidarko doesn't describe awe. He induces it with page-turning action, startling insights, and the kind of verbal grace that makes multi-page descriptions of, say, a flock of pelicans feel riveting and new. The canyon has no established through route. It is a living oven, full of scorpions, cactuses, venomous snakes, flash floods, and various other incarnations of hell on earth. Indeed, Grand Canyon is one of the deadliest national parks, and Fidarko relates in unflinching details the list of fatalities. Various tourists plummet off viewpoints, and a guy drowns while crossing rapids on an air mattress. By the time he explains how the canyon's extreme heat can cause the proteins in human cells to denature and congeal, as if one were boiling an egg, I wished he were a little less gifted in his descriptive powers. Fidarko's hiking companion is his longtime creative partner, the photographer Pete McBride. Each man often found the other to be madly annoying, writes Fidarko, but some of his warmest and funniest writing is about his friendship with McBride. Whether they're discovering ancient petroglyphs or wrenching pieces of cholla cactus off each other, McBride is made up of equal parts idealism and pig-headedness. He theorizes that they don't need to train because the hike itself is the thing that's going to get us in shape for the hike. Though Fidarko acknowledges, in a lengthy and diplomatic footnote, that his depiction of the duo's incompetence, while not technically inaccurate, may be played up for drama. That it annoys McBride, it seems, is only a side benefit. The canyon, unlike the reader, is unamused. The prospect of death very real. These men have to get their act together or quit. Though at times they come close to their demise, a team of magnanimous experts helps them to trek on. They encounter radioactive mine sites, wild horses, pools of dead tarantulas, and countless other shocks and wonders, such as a cactus that retracts into the dirt, and a carnivorous mouse that howls at the moon. Along the way, they and we meet many of the park's stakeholders, from indigenous activists to a professor of Euclidean numbers theory. Fidarko interweaves their stories with wry, precise distillations of natural history and incisive profiles of the investment interests that aim to squeeze wild nature into cash. The book never shies from its paradoxes. I did this so you don't have to. I did this because you shouldn't. I shouldn't have done this, but it's good I did. By the time the men complete their year-long hike, they've endured and overcome so much that they're briefly mistaken for plane crash victims. But in truth, they and we are pilgrims on holy ground. Readers will be tempted to visit the canyon just to keep the book's spell alive longer, and to feel Fidarko's company in their awe. A Walk in the Park, the true story of a spectacular misadventure in the Grand Canyon, by Kevin Fidarko, was published by Scribner at the price of $32.50. This New York Times trilobite, he took a terrible, horrible, no-good 800-mile hike, so you don't have to, was written by Blair Braverman and was published on November 26, 2024, in the New York Times. If you still need books for friends and family, hopefully one of these will be just the ticket. And note, many of these are available as audiobooks. Happy hunting. Also, remember that if you missed any part of this program today, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Happy holidays. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next Sunday.